Jesus' advent typified. The time of Christ's second coming is vividly portrayed in this portion of Joseph's history. At his first revelation to the Jews, he was rejected, even as his type of whom we are writing. But at his second advent, he will be received gladly. But as in the case before us, his people will be made ready for him by the tribulation and trouble into which they will be plunged. They will gradually be brought to a realization of their need and dependence upon him. Christ will begin to assume responsibility as the head over all things some years before he is actually revealed to the nations as their deliverer. But in the meantime, all his plans and purposes will be in view of their place. For as the ancient people of God, they will be in authority with him. They have been given the promises. Furthermore, Christ will not hesitate to declare his authority and power. He will take to himself all authority and will reign as the sovereign of the world. He will say to the people, even as Joseph, "Behold, I have bought you and your land today for Pharaoh." And he will be able to say it in a fuller, deeper sense than Joseph could, for Christ literally redeemed the world to God by his own blood. All men have been bought out of the hand of Satan because he paid the price for their redemption. It was only in a figurative way that Joseph could make this statement, but he kept them all alive by his astuteness and foresight, which wisdom was given him by the Lord. Joseph furnishes the people seed that they may sow the land, and when it yields its increase, Pharaoh is to have the fifth part. The latter is a hint of the much more which results to God because of redemption. Pharaoh is now enriched in every way. The famine has worked no evil to him. It has rather increased him to the uttermost. The people are literally his slaves. They acknowledge that Joseph has bought them and that everything they possess belongs to him. He surely had them in a corner. But this is only a figure of what Christ has accomplished for God. Hear the words of Paul. "Ye are bought with a price, therefore glorify God in your body and spirit, which are God's." 1 Corinthians 6:20. And when we acknowledge the above assertion and yield to him, we find that this becomes our actual experience. We are shut up to God. We cannot do as we please anymore or call anything we possess our own. He gets us cornered too. We become actually, experimentally helpless and dependent upon God. Then is when God is glorified in our lives. He can then work for us and through us. All things serve him. Observe that the Egyptians acknowledge the rule of Joseph, admit his claims, and yield to his authority. They say, "Thou hast saved our lives. Let us find grace in the sight of my Lord, and we will be Pharaoh's servants." Verse 22. And this, too, is suggestive of the old man, Egyptian, that is counted dead, being made to serve the new man, Joseph, who is counted alive forevermore. He is the king. The body is simply at his service, a slave having no voice or will in the matter. But to get back to our story, Joseph's father dwells with his son in the land of Goshen. They enjoy great possessions and are multiplied exceedingly. And Jacob lived 17 years after he came into Egypt, so his whole age was 147 years. These events are all significant and hints of millennial times and blessings. Things of time transitory. But now we have a change. The literal history rather than the typical now becomes prominent. We read, "And the time drew near that Israel must die." We are forcibly reminded by these words that Christ has not yet come. Joseph is only the figure, not the perfect image, for there will be no death for Jacob, nor any of his seed, when the Redeemer has come into Zion and taken up his abode with them. But we say Joseph's help was only temporary and transitory. He could only give material food, hence could not stay death except for the moment. Jacob must go the way of his fathers, but like them he died in faith, as we will see later. The grave did not speak to the patriarchs of the end. Oh no, Jacob may die and leave his people in Egypt and not in Canaan, but this is only because the words which were spoken to Abraham must be fulfilled. Know of a surety that thy seed shall be a stranger in a land that is not theirs, and they shall afflict them 400 years. Genesis 15:13. The latter part of the prophecy came to pass after the death of Joseph. God's purposes concerning his people must be fulfilled, though they suffer intensely in the process. Jacob, as his end approaches, calls for Joseph. He insists that he swear to him that he will not bury him in Egypt, but in the land of Canaan. He desires to lie with Abraham and Isaac, men of like faith with himself. It was not possible that they should be divided even in death. These three men are as one. They are a mighty proof, we may say, of the three persons of the Godhead. He designates himself the God of Abraham, Father, Isaac, Son, and Jacob, Holy Spirit, and each of these men actually portray in their lives these different persons. Joseph hastens to Jacob's bedside when he hears of his fast coming end, and he brings with him his two sons. The aged patriarch immediately speaks of God and his sure promise to him. It is marvelous to contemplate the calm, quiet assurance in which these men of faith gazed into the great unknown, as men speak, without fear or terror. Why? It was not unknown to them. God was there. They had learned his voice, and now when he calls them to pass out of the visible and material into the invisible and spiritual, there is no doubt, no hesitancy. God is faithful is their anchor. The past and future. Jacob reminds Joseph of those great promises that Jehovah gave him concerning his seed in the land of Canaan. He tells him that he claims his two sons, Ephraim and Manasseh, naming them in this order, though the last named was the elder. But God was directing Jacob. He is a prophet at this place, telling us of things that are to come. He claims these sons of Joseph even as his own sons, lining them up with Reuben and Simeon. He mentions Rachel and her death, which brought Benjamin on the scene. He came up in resurrection, as it were, figuring Christ, the risen, glorified man that is coming in power and great glory. Then Jacob looks upon the sons of Joseph, whom he has just claimed as his own, and asks, "Who are these?" It appears as though he had never seen them, but that is not so. These things are full of meaning. For as we intimated, Jacob is a prophet. Joseph answers, saying, "They are my sons whom God hath given me in this place." This would make it appear as though the people of the end, whom God will recognize, will be represented by two distinct companies, or rather we might call them nations. But God will see them as Ephraim and Manasseh. They are the children of Joseph, which would suggest that they figure the people of God that are on the scene at the end. These sons were born to him after his sorrow was all over and his head lifted up, all so fragrant of Christ's death and resurrection and exaltation. Jacob is overwhelmed with the fact that he is not only permitted to see Joseph again, but to behold his sons also. Oh, this is so wonderful to him. He wants to bless them ere he dies, as his father had blessed him. No doubt he is reminded of his brother Esau and his stolen birthright. And yet it was his by the edict of God. He had said to Rebekah, "The elder shall serve the younger." Jacob stealing the blessing was really only taking what was his own. You notice that God never rebuked nor chastened him for it. But now his eyes are growing dim, even as Isaac's had been when he blessed Jacob. He lays his hands upon the heads of Joseph's sons, but it appears as though he made a mistake. For his right hand he put on Manasseh, the elder. Now this was contrary to custom, but it is written that he did it wittingly. That is, he knew what he was doing. Joseph thinks that he has made a mistake and attempts to set him right. He says, "Not so, my father, for this is the firstborn. Put thy right hand upon him." His father refused, saying, "I know it, my son, I know it. And he shall become a people, and he also shall be great, but truly his younger brother shall be greater than he, and his seed shall become a multitude of nations." And he blessed them that day with a marvelous blessing and said, "In thee shall Israel bless, saying, God make thee as Ephraim and Manasseh." And he set the younger before the elder. He is a prophet here. He blessed Joseph by blessing his sons. He received the double portion of the birthright, Reuben having lost it. 1 Chronicles 5:1-2. And this, again, is but the lesson which is being continually repeated in the Scriptures. That was not first which is spiritual, but that which is natural, and afterwards that which is spiritual. 1 Corinthians 15:46. Then he bursts forth in a mighty eulogy of the God of his fathers, Abraham and Isaac, before whom they walked. He emphasizes God's faithfulness. He fed him and redeemed him from all evil. Hence, he can commit the sons of Joseph in confidence to him. Then he adds, "Behold, I die, but God shall be with you and bring you again unto the land of your fathers." He has no fear in the contemplation of death. Faith in Jehovah's sure word is the ballast and strength of his life. He gives Joseph one more portion than all his brethren, which is only just and right. Joseph was tried and proven. He suffered and then saved all Israel. He deserved the extra portion which his father left to him, even as Christ will have more than all his brethren. It is his due. Jacob announced the fact that the extra portion was one that became his by a special feat of prowess. "I took it out of the hand of the Amorite with my sword and my bow." The overcomer gets the overcomer's portion. In all of this, we see how Joseph fulfills his name, which signifies adding or increase. This is indeed the beautiful lesson of his life. In him we find emphasized the law of spiritual increase, as indicated by the name of his second son, Ephraim, fruitfulness. But the way to become fruitful in the real spiritual sense of the word is by way of Manasseh, forgetting. The Apostle Paul went this way to reach a fruitful state, as he tells the Philippians, "Forgetting those things which are behind, I press forward." Chapter 3:13. As to fact, Manasseh is the firstborn, but the end is greater than the means. God must have fruit from his people, but he can only get it as they forget all things and run the race to win. Nature would often resist God, get in his way, and hinder him, even as Joseph attempted to do here. But the prophet resists any interference. Ephraim is first with God. Men would turn it around and make the means the spectacular figure. But Paul says, "If by any means I may attain," the means are little or nothing. The end is everything. The prophecy of Jacob. After the private interview with Joseph is over, Jacob calls all his sons. Gather yourselves together that I may tell you what shall befall you in the last days. Chapter 49, verse 1. Observe that Jacob is about to tell them of events for the last days. We may learn some secrets if we have our ears open, for the dying patriarch stands here as a prophet. He holds up a beacon of light to illuminate the dark night of the end of the age. His words are, even as the other prophetic writings, truly a light in a dark place, whereunto Peter advises all to take heed. 2 Peter 1:19. Leah's children are the first enumerated in the prophecy. Then the sons of the two bondmaids, intermingled with one another, and lastly, Rachel's children. These are plainly divided into three groups, referring to different ranks in the resurrection or restoration of Israel. Reuben was the firstborn of Leah. Jacob calls him his might and the beginning of his strength, the excellency of his dignity and the excellency of his power. But yet we see him deposed from his place of primacy. Joseph, who stands for the very opposite of Reuben, gets what he loses. The latter refers to the first man, not necessarily as fallen, but to the man whom God created in his own image, though now fallen. He was given an intelligent will. He could choose for himself. Herein was what separated him from the beast. Without this will, he would have been a mere automation in his maker's hand, or other hands, or else as a ship at sea without a chart or compass. But sin has entered, and this free will has become self-will, an independent energy which, with vanity and emptiness, its center and seal. The verdict of Jacob upon his son is expressive of the instability of the natural man. Unstable as water, thou shalt not excel. Thus the will of man has lost its dignity and excellency. It becomes his degradation, and that which should be his glory as a man lowers him beneath the level of the beast. But we may well say, where is the blessing of Reuben in all this? For it is written, every one according to his blessing he blessed them. Verse 28. That is, according to that which would be a blessing in each case. Reuben's blessing, then, must be found in the fact that he is deprived of even that which he did possess. But this is blessing, though disguised, it is true, when the man accepts the humiliation and can say, even as the Lord said, not my will but thine be done. It is then that he gets his blessing and his glory returns to him. Yea, a greater glory rests upon him, the glory of the new man. He is indeed created in the image of his Father. God can look down upon him and really see a son. Reuben also speaks dispensationally of Israel's youth, the time when they came up out of Egypt, strong, virile, and energetic. They were put under the covenant of the law, that is, under responsibility to obey as the ground of blessing. Their instability and corruption were made manifest, whereby they were deposed from their supremacy among the nations, and the birthright passed to Christ, who alone is able to establish and support the throne. Joseph is his type. The blessing will come back to them through him after their deep humiliation has passed. Simeon and Levi are next in the line. They follow Reuben, even as violence and cruelty necessarily follow instability and corruption. These two sons of Leah are united as brethren in harmony as to character, and actually united in that terrible occasion to which Jacob here refers, Genesis 34:25. The thought of agreement is to the front in all that is said as to them. Their judgment, as we saw in Reuben's case, also works for blessing to them. Their disruption, scattering, etc., the doom pronounced against them, is the means whereby they are brought into loneliness, individuality, and weakness. The opposite of the strength which comes from union is the reproof and the remedy for violence and cruelty. Conscience is an individual thing and brings in God. The weakness of the man, the individual, makes God the necessary refuge, and the highest type of manhood is developed. Confederacy, union, brotherhood, and all the other devices of Satan to organize men are a curse. They strengthen them in their independence of God by making them dependent upon one another. They are all for the benefit or aggrandizement of some certain men and are begun in craft and guile, but soon develop into tyranny as power is acquired and finally end in violence and murder. As we intimated, it is the judgment pronounced upon them that is the sure remedy for the regathering of them into the true union or oneness with the Lord. Then men really enter into the signification of Simeon's and Levi's names. They begin to hear and listen to God, which is blessing indeed, and rejoice that they are separated from the old man with all that this implies, in order that they may be joined unto the Lord and in harmony with other men in an invisible fellowship or brotherhood, which has divine origin and sanction. In the new creation, Christian associations are a most important factor, second only to the fundamental one who is our master. The first, truly answered, makes way for the other. When we hear God and obey His voice, our relationship to other men and fellowship with them is governed by His word. The dispensation figured here follows in the history of Israel, the time when they heard God speak and were as one people. For later, because of corruption, the people were scattered and are still disrupted. But when they have learned the lesson which Jehovah would teach them, they will come into union again. It is in the last days, even as Jacob emphasized, when their divided condition, which bespeaks weakness and need, has become a reality to them, that they will hear Jehovah calling and they will heed His voice and become a nation again. Simeon and Levi will walk hand in hand once more. A nation will be born in a day. Judah's blessing. Judah, meaning praise, has the third place, though he was the fourth son. The prophecy of Jacob regarding him has naught of judgment or woe. His brethren shall praise him, they shall bow down to him. He is the conquering tribe, his enemies are in his power. He has them by the neck, Judah is a lion's whelp. There is no breaking of his power, for praise is the spirit of power. A praiseful saint is a powerful saint and vice versa. A gloomy, murmuring, critical saint is a powerless one. God calls on His people to praise Him. He challenges them to offer Him praise and thanksgiving, demands it of them as His due. Pay thy vows, He urges His people. Offer unto God thanksgiving. Bring forth the timbrel and the harp and make a loud noise unto Jehovah, are some of the many admonitions to praise God. How slow the greater part of His people is to pay debt of love and gratitude we owe to God for His grace. Praise to God is the proof of the life which comes from God. It turns back in adoration and worship to Him who is its source, even as Jesus said to the woman at the well, "The water that I will give him shall be in him a well of living water springing up into everlasting life." John 4:14. The reference in Jacob's prophecy to the vine speaks of the abundant wine, which is the portion of Judah, the sign of a joy that is akin to ecstasy, in the which there can be no excess. The eyes red with wine may figure his vision colored with the joy of the Lord. While the milk may speak of the nourishment that is found in Judah's blessing, as well as the stimulus. The special time in the history of Israel that Judah figures is no doubt when they entered the land of Canaan. That was where they manifested the victor life. The lion's whelp was in evidence. The Canaanites fled before their overcoming march. From the prey, my son, thou art gone up, is the powerful figure of speech which Jacob uses to describe their victory over their enemies. But there is a far greater fulfillment of this prophecy awaiting the Jew of the end. The nations will dare to rouse him up by besieging his city. He stooped down, he crouched as a lion, but as an old lion they will rouse him up. Christ is the full expression of this prophecy. He came in weakness once, but in power will his second advent be ushered in. The old lion will make his presence felt. He will roar after the prey. His people, the Jews, will win the battle because he will be the leader of the army of the Lord. Judah was the tribe which the other tribes should praise, for out of him came forth the cornerstone, out of him the nail, out of him the battle bow, and out of him every ruler together. Zechariah 10:4, Revised Version. All of which is redolent of Christ, who was of this tribe. He represents the kingly line. David, the sweet psalm singer and first God-given king of Israel, was of Judah. He wrote of the tribe, saying in one place, speaking for God, "In Judah is God known." Psalm 76:1. Again he wrote, "Judah is my lawgiver." Psalm 60:7. The prophetic character of Judah's name has long since been vindicated by the fulfillment of the scriptures. The rise of Judah to political power is connected with a revival of spiritual power. These two things, civil and religious powers, went hand in hand in Israel. Jacob's words, "The scepter shall not depart from Judah, nor a lawgiver from between his feet until Shiloh come, and to him shall the obedience of the people be," were fulfilled when Christ came. He was the man of peace, Shiloh. This prophecy compassed all the history of Israel from the time that Judah was chosen as the kingly tribe and the Davidic covenant given, 2 Samuel 2:7, to the cross and resurrection of Christ. And strange as this appears, Judah's scepter was then to pass away when we might argue the time had come for its permanency. But we know well the reason. The nation rejected their Shiloh, who had made peace by the blood which he shed. Again, we are impressed with the fact that prophecy justifies itself. The scepter has departed from Judah and will not return until Shiloh come again. Then unto him shall the gathering of the people be. Zebulun's blessing. He comes forth on Jacob's program, though he was the sixth son of Leah. His name, dwelling, is plainly referred to by Jacob in the prophecy. It is a dwelling with, that is, in intimate relationship, as Leah's use of it would indicate when she called her son Zebulun. Chapter 30, verse 20. Therefore, in this place, it has a bad significance. Zebulun dwelling at the haven of the sea with its border toward Zidon was plainly out of God's order. He was not dwelling in fellowship with God, for the one would exclude the other. We cannot be on terms of intimacy with the Lord and looking toward Zidon at the same time. The latter refers to the commercial world, a seeking after the things for which the nations are seeking. The inference is plain that this would be the spiritual condition or experience of Israel after their rejection of their God-sent deliverer, and so it is. But, says someone, where is the blessing of Zebulun in this prophecy? The answer is that the same principle applies in this connection as in that of the others. Israel did not want to dwell alone and not be reckoned among the nations. They wanted to be like the other folks, and they had their desire. God does not appear to come in at all, either to bless or judge, except that their portion comes to them through the very thing they desired. That is, they taste the bitterness of having their own way, and learn, even as we, by the result, the joy of letting the Lord choose for them. It is not the best way of gaining such knowledge, but often it is the only way to teach us. It is one of the all things that work good for us. Israel will find to their sorrow that it was well with them when they were dwelling in intimacy with God, and they will repent of their self-will, and thus their dwelling in the haven of the sea will finally yield a blessing to them. They will find anything and everything but a haven of rest under the wings of the nations, as the last days will show. And what the nations have been for Israel, we learn by the prophecy of the next tribe. Jacob calls Issachar a strong ass, though his name means there is reward, or my hire. He was Leah's fifth son, though in the prophecy he is in sixth place. His name has significance as relating to Israel. It is dwelt upon. He is seen as lying down, content to be the drudge of the Gentiles. They who would not endure the yoke of the Lord are now tamely submitting to that of men. Gain and ease they have sought and have found. How true to the character of the unbelieving nation. This prophecy of Jacob, even as the former, gives us the governmental ways of God in relation to his people, whether Israel or the church. If we do not yield to God, we will find ourselves bound by circumstances and people. And if we do not choose Christ's easy yoke, we will carry heavy burdens for others. Someone will be our master. God so ordains our ways, even as he did Israel's, that we may learn to dwell with him, to yield to him and serve him. For verily there is a reward in either case. We will reap even as we have sown. Our hire is sure. The prophecy concerning Leah's sons is now complete. We have in them the history of Israel, according to the flesh, from the time they came out of Egypt until the present time of God's apparent casting away of them. Other purposes regarding the nation are about to spring forth. Their day is about to dawn again, but as it is always darkest before the dawn, so in their case. There will first come a day of judgment such as never has been and never will be again. The prophecy concerning the children of the bondmaids represents this day of dire tribulation. For it is in Israel's time of deepest abasement and bondage that Jehovah brings in salvation for them. And this is what we find in Jacob's words to Dan, the first of these sons. Dan's blessing. We have in the prophecy of Dan, the judge, the restoration of Israel to self-government. For Jacob says, Dan shall judge his people as one of the tribes of Israel, though he is one of the least. The rise from the burdened hireling condition of which Issachar speaks is very evident. Yet it is at this very time that their deepest trouble and greatest failure is found. That explains the mingled character of the prophecy regarding Dan. It is very unusual. There seems to be a contradiction in the words of Jacob because two extremes apparently meet, God and Satan. The serpent in the way and the adder in the path, biting the horse's heels, can have no other reference than to Satan, and immediately follows these words, I have waited for thy salvation, O Lord. The explanation is that when Israel becomes a nation, partially free and independent, the devil will also be there. The Antichrist, claiming to be their Messiah, will present himself to them. He has been connected with the tribe of Dan by Jacob's prophecy. Whether this refers to the anti-prophet or the anti-king is not so clear. One of these men, counterfeits of Christ, will no doubt come of the tribe of Dan. Whether this fact will actually be known to the people, we cannot say. But he will be the serpent in the way and the adder in the path. His satanic character is thus emphasized, and it is that which causes the cry to come from Jacob, the prophet, speaking of the true believers of that day of unprecedented suffering. I have waited for thy salvation, O Lord. Thus they call him forth to their help, and they do not call in vain, as the next prophecy concerning the second son of the bondmaids evidences. Gad's blessing. A troop shall overcome him, but he shall overcome at the last or at the end. Again, we have the name emphasized in the prophecy. It is almost the entire thing here. Gad, a troop, shall rush upon him. Israel are in question here. The troop rushes upon them at first. They are apparently overcome, but the tables turn. They rush upon their opponents, and the latter are put to flight. The conflict at the end of the age is depicted by this prophecy of Gad. The Lord is seen with his troop coming to the help of his helpless people, who have been almost overcome. Then, right in line, comes Jacob's words to the next son of the bondmaids, Asher, the happy one. Asher's blessing. The above is surely evident in his very name. He is happy. Therefore, he is blessed. He tells us of Israel's quiet possession of the land, their happiness after the deliverance wrought for them by their long-looked-for Messiah. Sorrow and sighing will be ended forever for them. His bread shall be fat, and he shall yield royal dainties to the king. What a beautiful prophecy. No lack to them, and no lack in their yielding to King Jesus. Their larder will never be empty. They will be fed and then give freely of their love and gratitude to feed royal dainties to him who has shown them such favor. Naphtali's blessing. Jacob says Naphtali is a hind let loose. He giveth goodly words. Here the meaning of the name is not dwelt upon. In fact, the wrestler, Naphtali, ceases his warfare and becomes as gentle and harmless as a hind, a female deer. Israel will have nothing to fear or dread. The prophecy informs us that the nation will be free, let loose, and give goodly words. That is, they will be the preachers of good tidings to the nations. Their tongue will be loosed, and they will witness to the world of the goodness and mercy of the Lord. There will be no law or self-effort in that message of goodly words. They will be as a hind let loose. The prophecy is a poem. Jacob's prophecy has compassed almost the whole of Israel's history. We have seen them at peace in their own land with salvation assured to them because the Lord has come to their deliverance. And yet we have not had the prophecy concerning Rachel's two sons. But we are in no doubt concerning them. Joseph, the one separated from his brethren, we have become well acquainted with in our study. Also Benjamin, the son of the right hand, is no stranger. Christ is the answer to both of these sons of Rachel, the beloved wife of Jacob. As Joseph, the nation would not accept Christ. They clung to Benjamin, but did not know that he was dependent for his place upon Joseph, the suffering Messiah. In Jacob's prophecy, they are joined together, for they cannot be separated, though Joseph is the principal one. But we cannot have the one without the other. Joseph's blessing. A fruitful bough or tree is Joseph in Jacob's prophecy. He was said to be planted by a well or spring, And so luxuriant and flourishing were his branches that they ran over the wall. This is easy to interpret. Christ is this fruitful tree, so nourished and maintained by the living power of the Holy Spirit, that his branches ran over the Jewish wall and brought salvation to the Gentiles. They too may partake of this tree of life planted by the rivers of waters, whose leaf never withers and whose fruit never fails. He was hated and sorely grieved. The archers shot at him, wounded and bruised him. But the chastisement of our peace was upon him, and by his stripes we are healed. They killed him, but that was only the way of life for him. He arose from the dead. His bow abode in strength in resurrection. The arms of his hands were made strong by the mighty one of Jacob. God was back of him, the arms of his hands. Christ arose. Resurrection confirmed him as the cornerstone and the shepherd of Israel. Then follows in the prophecy the blessings, multiplied best blessings upon the head of Joseph, blessings of the heavens above, blessings of the earth beneath. All things heavenly and earthly yield up their hidden wealth and varied store to Joseph. Nature is called forth to produce to the uttermost for this fruitful one. His seed is blessed and made a blessing. The blessing of Jacob upon the head of this much-loved son has prevailed and has outdone and overtopped all the blessings that have been spoken heretofore. Abraham's blessing as well as Isaac's blessing, though marvelous, are nothing to be compared with the blessings upon the head of Joseph. Observe that he is marked out, as it were, as the one separated from his brethren. The cross divided Christ from his brethren. He was blotted out of Israel. But it is by the way of the cross that he becomes fruitful. As he said, except a corn of wheat fall into the ground and die, it abideth alone. But if it die, it bringeth forth much fruit. John 12:24. Likewise, Joseph also was separated from his brethren. Benjamin's blessing. Benjamin follows, for he is the complement of Joseph. His blessing is meager compared with that of Joseph, but it is, as we intimated, because these two are as one. Benjamin shall raven as a wolf, Jacob informs us. He figures Christ coming as the judge of the people. He will tear the high things down and devour the proud and presumptuous. In the morning he rises up in wrath to destroy his enemies, but in the evening the battle is all over. He divides the spoil. At the best, Benjamin's blessing is only that he prepares the people for Joseph. It is because Christ's victory and exaltation are dependent upon the cross. The one separated from his brethren is the answerer of every question, the dissolver of every doubt, the basis of every blessing. The Messiah believed in and desired by the Jews is little compared to the greater and more marvelous figure whom they rejected. Though Christ is the fulfillment of both types, the one came in mercy, the other will be revealed in judgment, his needed though strange work. Then Joseph will come again. We have come to the last chapter in our study book. It has a solemn ending, but not in unbelief, even though its subject, we might say, is death. Jacob dies and Joseph also goes into the tomb, but in the faith of resurrection. It is marvelous how the narrative breathes of hope regardless of the visible death. They are but asleep, they seem to say. The night will pass, the morning will come again. Jacob charges his sons not to bury him in Egypt. He insists that they take his body back to Canaan and lay it in the burying place of his fathers. This is emphasized as the cave of Ephron the Hittite in the field of Machpelah, which tells of hope and resurrection. The tomb in which he was to lay was that which Abraham bought of the Hittite, terror. Christ robbed death of its terror by going into the grave and coming out again. There is no fear of death to the one that enters it in faith, as Jacob did. These men, Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, looked beyond their day to the coming of one who would despoil death. They looked for the Redeemer, and they have not believed in vain. He has been here and unlocked the prison house of their departed spirits, if not their bodies, and taken them up above with him. Listen to these words telling of Jacob's pilgrimage. He gathered up his feet into his bed, yielded up his spirit, and was gathered unto his people. No fear, no moan, no sigh recorded. He was simply going to sleep. His master had bidden him go on, and he obeyed. We read of no panic-stricken family, no running for the doctor or medicine bottle. No, all things are peaceful and quiet. Joseph fell on his father's face weeping, and he and his brethren mourned for Jacob. There was a great and sore lamentation when they came into the land of Canaan, for a great company escorted Jacob to his burial. Many of the Egyptians came with their horses and chariots, men of might and renown in their land. And it is said that the Egyptians mourned with a great and sore lamentation. The world has no faith. Death has not been robbed of its terror for them. They have no hope of a resurrection. The mourning was held in the threshing floor of Atad, thorn, which tells the story. The Egyptians see in death naught but a curse, a thorn in the flesh. The Canaanites see the big funeral and are impressed. The Egyptians see the death and are depressed. But faith sees the resurrection and is expressed on its way for the prize of the high calling of God, the out resurrection and out translation. The mourning was held in the threshing floor of Atad, thorn, which tells the story. The Egyptians see in the death naught but a curse, a thorn in the flesh. The Canaanites see the big funeral and are impressed. The Egyptians see the death and are depressed. But faith sees the resurrection and is expressed on its way for the prize of the high calling of God, the out resurrection and out translation. But Joseph's brethren are not yet aware of all the love in his heart for them. They are afraid he will do them evil now that their father is gone. Hence they send a message asking his forgiveness. They say to him that his father told them to do this. But we infer that the condemnation arose in their own bosom, and that Jacob had no such fear of his beloved son. Joseph weeps and assures them of his love and forgiveness, saying, "Fear not, for I am in the place of God." Oh, what a marvelous picture of Christ and the millennium, but yet only the shadow, as the chapter shows. Joseph too dies, but he is not lost to them. Here is an exception to all the others in death. He is not buried. They are to keep his bones in readiness to depart, for there is no thought of a burial in Egypt. Israel going up out of Egypt is viewed by Joseph. It was real to him. He had the substance of it because he had the faith. They were, in type, carrying about in the body the dying of Jesus, as we are bidden, that the life also of Jesus might be manifested in the body. Christ is no longer dead, for salvation is the proof that he lives. We are admonished to make manifest his life. This is the purpose of his death, that life shall be appropriated and shown in the days of our pilgrimage. A few more words and we are through with our book. It began with a man in a beautiful garden with everything to make life worth living, but it ends with man in death. Sin had entered and changed things, and here we see what the end of man would be if God had not come to his help. And though man lost his natural life, yet we see a hint of another life in the bones of Joseph, which were not buried, but simply embalmed and laid away to wait another day. Thus, Genesis justifies its name, life, though it ends with the symbol of death, a coffin. The end. Be an overcomer. Be an overcomer with the Lord, armored for the conflict by his word. Waiting for his orders, yield your hand, going on to win at God's command. Be an overcomer in the field. Bear a shining helmet, sword, and shield. Ready, quick to answer, here am I. Never ask a question where or why. Be an overcomer in the fight, loyal as a witness to the light. Stand against the foe in Canaan's land, faint, yet ere pursuing with God's band. Be an overcomer, choose to share Jesus' deep abasement, though unfair, yet with him in glory, tried and true, crowned with honors in the grand review. This concludes the reading of Lessons in Genesis, Volume 2, by Mary M. Bodie.